Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to helping farm families succeed by offering financial products and services geared specifically to agriculture and rural communities and developing partnership-based relationships with its member owners.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 11th day of July 2018. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office this afternoon. However, we will have an update of the commodity markets and the prices from the CME Group in Chicago. Jackie Vakes from Stuart Peterson should be here to bring us up to speed on what's been happening there. And then a bit later in the program, we'll talk with Bill Davison. He's a University of Illinois Extension educator and part of a large grant that was given to the U of I and others by the United States Department of Agriculture to look at the vigor of organic corn and how to increase it. It has to do with open pollinated corn. It's a very interesting discussion. Speaking of open pollinated corn, we'll continue our conversation about the history of corn. Oh, and we'll take up the story of soybeans as well. You'll want to stay with us as we make our way through this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org. Now, let's get a quick update on farm management. Well, Japanese beetles are showing up in corn and soybean fields. These can do enough damage to cause yield losses, but it's fairly unlikely. The University of Illinois has published thresholds for when farmers should spray crops to protect them from the Japanese beetle. Nick Sider says there needs to be a lot of beetles and a whole lot of damage done before a producer should spend money on a rescue treatment.
Most of the reports that I'm getting, as you would expect and as is typical, are below the treatment thresholds we have, which are 25% after bloom, 35% before bloom, soybean. And the thresholds for silt clipping in corn are, you know, consistent clipping down to half an inch or less pretty regularly throughout the field. A question yesterday about what to do when you have both Japanese beetles and corn rootworm clipping silks in the field. And the answer is the same. It still has to be that clipping down to half an inch or less consistently through the field while pollination is still ongoing.
Again, Illinois Extension entomologist Nick Sider says farmers have no need to apply a rescue treatment for Japanese beetles until defoliation reaches at least 25% after bloom for soybean. And silk clipping during pollination is down to half an inch or less for corn.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really. Thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalo. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for more than 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Good afternoon. I'm Jackie Vakes from Stuart Peterson with the closing market report for Wednesday, January 11th. Todd is traveling today. Trade today was weaker, putting in new contract lows in both corn and beans, so this is how the board closed. September corn down 7 1/4 at 340.5. December corn down 7 1/4 at 353.5. September beans down 23.5 at 837.5. November beans down 23 3/4, down 847 3/4. September Chicago wheat down 18 3/4 at 473 1/4. December Chicago wheat down 18 at 492. We have August live cattle down 160 at 103.85. October down 157.5 at 106.25. August lean hogs down 97.5, excuse me, at 86.80. And October at down 175 at 52.05. Crude oil today for August down 398 so far at 70.13. The U.S. dollar up 59 at 94.74.40, and the Dow Jones down 243.25 at this moment at 24,676. Some of the action today can be attributed to China vowing to retaliate if the U.S. implements the 10% tariffs announced yesterday. There's a difference, though, this time. Tariffs will be open to public comment prior to the implementation date of August 31st. Tomorrow, we'll see the USDA release its supply and demand report at 11 o'clock. Average guesses are corn production, 14,331,000,000, which would be up 291 million bushels from last month. Soybeans, 4,329,000,000, up 49 million bushels from last month. Corn yield, 175.3 bushels to the acre, up 1.3 bushels. Soybeans, 48.8 per acre, up 3/10 of a bushel. U.S. ending stocks, now here's the big question. Will the WASD adjust the numbers for the expected drop in demand due to tariffs? So we'll find that out tomorrow. On corn, carryout, $2.1 billion, up $4 million from last month. Beans, $507 million, up $2 million from last month. Wheat, $1 billion, $98 million, up $18 million. At the corn level, 191.3 million metric tons of corn expected, down 1.4 million metric tons. Soybeans, 92, down 500,000 metric tons, and wheat, 272.3, down 1/10 of a million metric tons. For 18-19, we see corn coming in at the world level at 156 million metric tons, 1.3 million metric tons up from last month. Soybeans, 88.6, down 0.4 million metric tons, and wheat, 264, down 2.1 million metric tons. Corn for Brazil, 83.1, that's down 1.7 million metric tons. Soybeans, 118.9, down 1/10 of a million metric tons. And in Argentina, corn at 32.7, which is down 3/10 of a million metric ton. And soybeans at 36.7, down 3/10 of a million metric tons. Todd and I have been talking quite a bit about the new Brazilian freight rates. This week, the Brazilian Congress is going to be voting on whether they pass it or not. Under the new rate, the cost of freight from Petula to Santos, which is 1,302 miles, would be approximately $3.19 per bushel if the truck returns loaded. If not, it's $4.65 a bushel. Since the new rate is essentially one size fits all, the greater the distance, the greater the cost. So if Congress does pass this, the rates are going to be very bad news for the Brazilian farmer who's already struggling with economic problems, lack of trucks to haul grain, and the freight situation, as well as higher input costs. This is today's WILL Closing Market Report. I'm Jackie Vakes.
For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Well, today in our second in a series of three reports on the history of the soybean, University of Illinois plant geneticist Ted Heimowitz takes us back to the first introduction of the soybean to the United States. That story begins prior to the Revolutionary War with a single individual who sailed the seven seas and brought the soybean to North America from China. Well, in 1758, Samuel Bowen signed on as a sailor with a ship called the Pitt. He was an Englishman The ship sailed to India, and then on to Hong Kong. From there, says plant geneticist Ted Heimowitz, Samuel Bowen signed off the pit and onto a ship called the Success. Heimowitz and a friend spent 2 years tracking Mr. Bowen's movements by researching the University of Illinois Library. Anyway, the Success, says Heimowitz, sailed north from Hong Kong to Tianshan, China.
There, the ship was captured because the British were not supposed to be trading other than in Hong Kong, and the emperor was annoyed. The ship was never seen again, probably sunk. And Mr. Bowen and those people on the ship were held hostage, Mr. Bowen writes, for 3 years. He was held a hostage. And eventually imprisoned in Hong Kong. Actually, Macau, next door.
Samuel Bowen was eventually released and made his way back to the colonies, in this case Savannah, Georgia. He brought with him a bag of beans, soybeans. It was the mid-1760s. Now, Mr. Bowen was something of an entrepreneur. In 1767, Bowen was issued a royal patent for soy sauce. He'd acquired some property in Georgia and was growing and pressing soybeans into sauce on a farm he called Greenwich. The sauce was grown for export to England.
And it was quite a business. He was an entrepreneur because he also had the idea of crushing peanuts for oil. And in fact, we have records that he did it. So he was an entrepreneur. Unfortunately, he died 10 years later, and in 1777.
Despite his death, Bowen had managed to leave a legacy, the soybean. The first recorded evidence of the soybean in the United States belongs to him. The minutes from a 1765 meeting of a Philadelphia Society for the Promotion of Agriculture acknowledges the receipt of 6 bottles of soy and seeds of Chinese vetch from Samuel Bowen. And that is one story of how the soybean arrived in North America. There are others, and Ted Heimowitz harbors one of them, but they cannot be proven. So it's a ship called the Success, Chinese imprisonment, and Samuel Bowen that are credited with the introduction of the soybean to North American farmers. We're now joined by Bill Davidson. We're now joined by University of Illinois Extension's Bill Davidson. He's involved in an organic corn grant from the United States Department of Agriculture. Bill, thanks so much for being with us. Can you tell me a bit about this grant and its purpose?
Sure. So we received $2 million from the USDA for 4 years of funding to breed corn for organic farms. So we're working with faculty and researchers at University of Illinois, University of Wisconsin, and some other partners to specifically focus on breeding for organic farms, so breeding corn plants that are adapted to those conditions.
So what kinds of things are you and the rest of the folks that are in the grant looking at on the breeding side to begin with? Do you have an idea where they'll be heading?
I do, yep. So we are basically trying to create plants that are optimal for organic conditions. So we're trying to create robust, resilient plants that are nutrient efficient, that grow quickly in cool soil so they can compete with weeds. And they're just, it's a very different set of conditions than they incur on conventional farms. And so that's part of the motivation and reason for pursuing this. But what we hope to create are plants that will help farmers have reasonable and consistent year-to-year yields with the potential to lower their input costs. So ultimately, this can help them have more profitable business models.
Oh, over time, we would call that hybrid vigor. So the ability of the hybrid or the corn seed to pop up out of the ground quickly early in the season, and that could be under cool and wet conditions. And so you're hopeful that through conventional breeding techniques or other techniques that you'll be able to provide more hybrid vigor.
Well, so that's part of what we're trying to do with this grant, is to combine modern breeding techniques for hybrid corn and open pollinated corn with the more traditional technique. So we have the ability to do both of those things to create new plants. And so a lot of farmers have misconceptions, I would say, about open pollinated versions of corn. So corn exists on a spectrum from the tightly controlled hybrid corn to the old open pollinated versions at the other extreme, but there's a lot of variation in between. So part of what we could do with this grant is breed modern versions of open pollinated plants, which would have modern genetics and diverse genetics, which can confer resilience and adaptability. So many people have had bad experiences with old versions of open pollinated corn, and it tends to close off their perception to the potential that it has. So that's part of what we hope to show and convey at field days that are coming up and at our workshops, is that we have a lot of options, but we need farmers to engage in that process and help us figure out the best way to go.
And so for some historical context, just prior to the turn of the last century, or from the 1800s to the 1900s, most of the corn in the United States was open pollinated corn, and there were about 1,000 open pollinated yellow corn varieties at that point. They had transitioned from white corn, which was grown previously to that, on open pollination, mostly on some of the work that came out of, I believe, Wisconsin, that showed carotene or yellow corn helped hogs to gain weight much faster. And then in the early 1920s, the Funk brothers, the folks over at Pioneer Seeds, Mr. Wallace and company, started looking at hybrids. And they all adapted an open pollinated corn variety called Reed's Yellow Dent, which has its home right here in the state of Illinois, just outside of Delavan, in fact. And so the open pollinated corn bill was simply that. You could take the variety and plant it again, and it would come up and produce just like it did in the previous season. However, hybrids and hybridization does not do that. So you're trying to meld these two together with some of those. I take it some of those old varieties, one of them that I think about, and somebody gave me an ear years ago. He said, have you ever seen an ear this long before? And it's called Longfellow. And that had to be, I don't know, 15 or 16 inches long. It was truly an incredibly long ear. So you're looking to meld all of those together to provide a commodity that's stable and that can yield and has vigor, I take it then.
That's right. I actually have Longfellow in one of my mixes. I've combined about 50 varieties into one population of Flint corn. And I'm growing that out and working with that, sort of exploring genetic diversity and what it can do for corn. But we also have Reed's Yellow Dent in some of our what we call synthetic varieties, and that just means that we're combining modern genetics, like modern hybrids, in an open pollinated form. So we have the benefits of all the work that's been done on hybrid corn, which has been remarkable. They're truly impressive plants. We just have the ability now to do more. If we can get people to support the work, we have the ability to develop more local infrastructure. So we're working with corn breeders that want to breed open pollinated corn for local markets, but we have to help them figure out the business model because that's a difficult thing to do. So that's another part of this grant, is looking at how we can bring farmers together with local businesses and develop those.
So why would you want, is it driven by consumer demand for something that's locally sourced and even more locally adapted to the environment? That's the way the open pollinated generally happen to be. Or is there something about these open pollinated corn varieties and their characteristics that you're hoping to incorporate?
Well, part of it is, you know, overall resilience and the ability to adapt and respond to the environment and be updated annually based on current conditions. So there are real benefits to working with nature in that way. But we will create a wide variety of plant types that everything from, you know, commodity type, you know, number two yellow dent that is just more nutrient efficient than what's currently available, all the way down to the open pollinated plants that would give farmers access to local markets based on quality parameters. Sometimes that's the color of the kernel or some nutritional or flavor component that would give you a new market. So part of this is, you know, trying to help farmers to diversify their marketing outlets so they have a little more control over some aspects of that.
And finally, there are a couple of conferences that are coming up fairly soon, one here in the state of Illinois, one in Wisconsin. Can you tell me about the Illinois conference and where it is, what it is, and who you hope to attract?
Sure. The first one coming up is July 19th. And it is just west of Champaign-Urbana. And this is a field day and workshop. So we have a network of farmers around across Illinois and Wisconsin that are growing out trials for us. And this is one of the sites. So we have lots of different types of hybrid corn and open pollinated corn planted out on this farm. We're going to meet there, look at the plots, hear from all of the faculty and researchers that are working on the project about what they've done to date and what they plan to do in the future. And so we'd like to bring together farmers and consumers to get their input on how we can best serve them and build this system.
How do people find out more information about this? It has a title. Does it have a web page? And can you call your local extension office?
Well, it's on a press release through the College of ACES. I manage a few websites where it's posted. There's a one site I manage that's called the Grand Prairie Grain Guild, where I catalog my work with corn and also share all of the press releases for events for this grant. That's a Facebook group. People can join that if they'd like to follow in that way.
And I'll take it and put it up on the willag.org website, probably in the calendar, so it won't necessarily be on the front page. But if you hit the calendar, you'll find that there on the 19th of July. And some of the information from the press release, and this is open to everybody. And it's interesting that you want both consumers and farmers there. I think that both could find benefit from having each other there. And it's about fulfilling a niche market, I suppose, and I'm going to call it that, and connecting people from one side to the other.
That's right. That's why we want the end users there, to make sure that we are growing what they want to buy.
Interesting enough. Bill, thank you so much. Anything else about this conference? It's called what? Amazing? All one word?
Yes. Lowercase a, capital M, and then AIZEING, amazing field day.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. We appreciate talking with you.
Well, thank you.
Bill Davison is with Illinois Extension. You can check out details about the amazing conference on our website at willag.org. Look in the calendar of events under July the 19th. I'm Todd Gleason.
It's National Blueberry Muffin Day. The word muffin first appeared in Britain around the 11th century. But until the 20th century, muffins were not a marketable baked good because of their size. They grew stale too quickly. It's also St. Benedict Feast Day, patron of farm workers. On this day in agricultural history in 1792, the first issue of the Farmer's Almanac was published by Robert Bailey Thomas. The journal contained long-term weather predictions, planting schedules, astronomical tables, astrological lore, recipes, anecdotes, and other stories of rural interest. The journal has been published every year without a break to the present day. By the way, the first issue sold sold 3,000 copies. That number tripled in the second year of publication, and by the time of Thomas's death, sales had swelled to 250,000 copies. In 1826, John Fowler was born. Fowler, an English engineer, helped develop the steam-hauled plow and several other specialty-use plows, including the mold drainage plow shown at the Great Exposition of 1851. Fowler died of tetanus after being thrown from a horse. And in 1987, according to the United Nations, world population hit 5 billion people. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
In the 1920s, U.S. corn farmers were still planting open-pollinated corn. About 1,000 genetically different varieties existed, and most of them were white dent corn. A few were high-yielding yellow dent varieties. They were popular throughout the Corn Belt and became even more so when swine feeding trial studies proved hogs did better eating yellow corn because it contained vitamin A. A Reed Yellow Dent was the most popular open-pollinated corn variety in states like Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa. But the farther north you went, the less tolerant it was of the shorter, drier growing season. Well, the University of Minnesota went to work on the problem and solved it with a yellow dent corn called Minnesota 13. These two varieties, says Forrest Troyer, set the stage for the development of hybrid corn. By 1920, the double-cross hybrid method had been developed by Donald Jones. Still, it remained difficult to find 4 inbreds good enough to make a double-cross to sell. Henry Wallace, who founded the Pioneer Seed Company in Iowa, sold the first double-cross hybrid in 1924. It was called Copper Cross. It wasn't until 10 years later, in 1934, that hybrid corn varieties even made a dent in U.S. corn production. Forrest Troyer says that year, 0.3% of all corn sold for seed in the U.S. was a hybrid.
And Iowa was the fastest growing, partly because of the work that the editorials that Henry Wallace wrote for Wallace's Farmer. And by World War II, by 1941, 1942, I believe 90% of the corn in Iowa was hybrid, and the rest of the Corn Belt wasn't far behind. Just a few more years, you know, that they it was an amazing thing once it got going. It was quickly accepted.
In 1934, that 0.3% of hybrid seed sold in the U.S. came primarily from 2 companies: Pioneer and the Funk Brothers Seed Company of Bloomington, Illinois. In 1935, Troyer says the first Ag Experiment Station hybrid was introduced, U.S. 13. A year later, Iowa 939 was released. In those early years of hybridization of corn, it was thought farmers would buy the original material and then produce their own hybrids. That's how open-pollinated crosses had been adapted throughout the Midwest, but the model didn't work for hybrid corn. So the corn seed companies prospered. Pioneer and Funk, along with DeKalb, were the 3 largest. These 3 companies and the experiment stations used the available open-cross yellow-dent corn to develop their hybrids. It was at this point that the majority of the genetic diversification of the domesticated corn plant was lost. Today's hybrid corn comes from about 8 genetically different open-pollinated yellow-dent corn lines. They include Lemming, Lancaster, Reed Yellow Dent, Minnesota 13, Northwestern Dent, Funk's Yellow Dent, and Troyer's Reed, along with 176A.
But over time, the thing that happened is that those inbreds that came from those popular varieties became the backbone of the hybrid seed corn industry. And what it really amounted to, as more emphasis was put on white adaptation of the hybrids, the inbreds from the varieties that did well over a more widely adapted area came to the forefront, and they're the backbone of the hybrid seed corn industry today.
Today, Forest Royer says half of the seed corn sold can trace its heritage to Reed Yellow Dent. Another 20% is directly related to Lemming, Lancaster, Minnesota 13, and Northwestern Dent. It's a narrow genetic base from which to work. He says it confines the ability of corn breeders to continue improving Yellow Dent corn. And in a world which is expected to grow by 4 billion people in the next 30 years, that could be a problem. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.